the first assassination attempt, and you made a pretty explicit claim that there was going to be more. And after the second assassination attempt, I hit you up. I was like, all right, we have to talk about this.
This is a narrative that they're setting up here because they want to kill Trump, but they want to blame somebody else for it. And then, of course, they get the twofer of them being able to say, well, Iran killed Trump, so we have to go to war with Iran. To listen to Jamie Dimon speak, he's like, we need to let Trump come back to power, and the hell with Ukraine. Everything that happened between World Wars One and Two, relative to currencies and debt and everything else, were all designed to get the desperation here is all on the part of people who have the most to lose by Trump returning to power. And that would be Europe and the British. And it's always the same people over and over again. They need a war to cover the fact that they're defaulting. So with all of this and the coup story and the this, that, and everything else, if you string all those pieces together, did Joe Biden make a deal with Trump?
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
I can't wait until the day that we do this in person because we don't have to worry about these technical difficulties.
Yeah, that would be fun. So one of these days, if you're ever in Florida or you know, or I get up in your area of the planet, we will. And you know, it'll be fun.
Do you make it to Texas often?
Texas, God no. Last time I was in Texas was for the Ron Paul conference when I did the speech out there. And then before that it was like to go to on a cruise like 15 years before. So, I mean, I drove through Texas actually once since then. So I just know I never leave the house, Marty. They don't let me out of the house. Like I'm not fit for human consumption. Come on.
Honestly, first time I came to Texas was 3 months before I moved here. I was bunkered up in the Northeast most of my life. You're saying before we had technical difficulties drinking tonight, 7 p.m., 7:10 now, Central Time, 8:10 East Coast. You got a storm headed your way. Hurricane season still. Actually, this is
this is late, I think, in the season. I think the hurricane season technically goes until November. My partner Dexter White knows this stuff far better than I do because like he lives in a far worse, far higher risk zone in Florida than I do. I actually live in like the one part of Florida that never gets directly hit, so it's really kind of awesome. We get prepped for the hurricane. We do the thing. We lose power because of where we live. Right, because we're the last ones to lose power and the last ones to get it back because we're at the end of the grid. Right, the grid literally stops at my house, and so you know if there's any surge whatsoever, we lose my neighborhood will lose power, even if it's just a surge that blows the breaker on the substation at the head of the but then it takes 4 or 5 days for somebody to come out and check the breaker because we're the lowest population density in the area, so we're the ones that get service last. It's just the way it always works out. So
low man on the totem pole.
Happens.
I got stuck in New York City during Sandy. That was fun. Visiting my now wife, at the time girlfriend, from Chicago.
First time
I went to visit her too, and I got stuck in her apartment for awesome. 4 extra days. Yeah.
Well, you know, I hope you made the best of it.
Well, it turned out well. We're married, 2 children now.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, like adversity brings people together. It's a good thing. If you had to be stuck in New York without power, God, that sounds like hell to me, right? Having lived adjacent to New York City, when I was growing up, like the idea of being without power in New York City for 4 days is just anathema.
Well, we were, Lord of the Flies, figuring out what happens when the world goes to shit. We were on the Upper East Side, so we were, or she was at the time. Right. So we were the apartment that everybody was flocking to charge their phones.
And, you know, wow. Yeah, no, I and that's what I'm thinking. Like, that's part of the reason why I don't live anywhere where, I live in the middle of kind of nowhere, kind of not too far from anywhere. Right. I'm only like a couple, like 5 minutes away from like the grocery store. But the way it works out, because I'm just over the county line, like I'm in the weird services dead zone. Right. And it just happens to be that, you know, once you leave the town that I live north of, there's nothing there for another 25 miles. Right. It's like it's Florida. There's cities and there's a couple of feeder towns and then there's nothing. And then there's the next city. And then and that's just the way it is. And it's, especially North Florida is dotted that way. So, you know, it has its advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is, well, you know, if you're without power for 4 days, it's not going to be order of the flies. And you're not going to have to worry about, you know, people randomly wanting to steal your shit. And on the other hand, the wind blows and the power goes out for 4 days.
Yeah. So. Sounds a lot like Texas, actually.
Yeah. So.
Speaking of hurricanes, I mean, that's the reason I brought you on is leading because I hit you up because I don't know if you recall, but in July when we recorded, it was right after the first assassination attempt and you made a pretty explicit claim that there was going to be more. And after the second assassination attempt, I hit you up. I was like, all right, we have to talk about this. There's a hurricane brewing, if you will.
Right. Right.
Allow me to analogize here, leading up to the election. It's all very weird now because the second assassination attempt, obviously on the golf course, guy seems like a kook, seems like the government was very well aware of him. What's going on in your mind?
I always defaulted that these people are straight out of central casting and, you know, and I can't get away from that. I'm not saying that I know that for certain. This guy looks like a true believer that they probably radicalized and all the rest of it. That's fine. But, you know, there's too much smoke here. And the fact that the Justice Department is blocking the state of Florida from doing an investigation into this is a telltale sign that there's something to hide. I mean, why would they hide? Well, you know, if this guy was just a random crazy, well, then just let it go to discovery and let this guy go to jail and, you know, let the state do their job. But no, the feds want to step in and, you know, take the investigation over and whitewash it and throw it under the rug. Like, there's clearly smoke here. And I thought it was a cool thing on DeSantis's part, Governor DeSantis's part, to force that issue into the open. That's what he's supposed to do. So, and that's his dog whistle of saying, look, this is a state issue. And this is a state crime. You know, I'm sorry. It just is. It's attempted murder. And, you know, that's our job.
You predicted this. Many people predicted this. Leading up to the election, things are going to get extremely chaotic, more chaotic by the day. They have today. Apparently, there was a third assassination attempt. Iran has him in the crosshairs. And then you have all these things going on in parallel. Israel creeping into Lebanon. Zelensky coming to Pennsylvania, nobly campaigning for Kamala Harris. And I'm at the point where I'm completely confused because I'm like, what is going on here? Because the Iran thing doesn't make, like, what do they have to gain here?
They don't have anything to gain. So this is a pure kind of psyop thing. Like, I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. Like, when Mark Levin is out there kind of screaming, Iran's trying to kill Trump. Like, oh, please. Like, Mr. Neocon himself is out there screaming for war on. What a shock. No, this is a narrative that they're setting up here. Because they want to kill Trump, but they want to blame somebody else for it. And then, of course, they get the twofer of them being able to say, well, Iran killed Trump, so we have to go to war with Iran, blah, blah, blah. Like, they're desperate. The desperation here is all on the part of the people who have the most to lose by Trump returning to power. And that would be Europe and the British. And it's always the same people over and over again. They need a war to cover the fact that they're defaulting. They want to default. They need to default. They're going to default. There's nothing they can do to stop it. Even with Powell cutting interest rates by 50 basis points the other day, the markets have sold off in a way that they shouldn't have with that kind of with that kind of result. And if we're having like connection issues, it's, you know, we have a hurricane Starlink. Coming through, and I'm on Starlink, so yeah. I'm at you know, I can see myself, like my feed is terrible, so I can only imagine what you guys are seeing. And I, you know, I apologize, but there's nothing I can do about it. You know, I'll just call up the God and tell them to hold the hurricane off for an hour, and then we can go on with the world, right? So, but that's, you know, that's a cover story, okay? You've got, you know, von der Leyen and Starmer putting out photo ops on the sidelines of the UN. They're desperate to try and force the United States into this these conflicts, and the Pentagon has clearly made it that they're not interested in fighting a war with either Russia, and barely are even willing to fight to show up and fight for the Israelis here. So there's something else going on. The State Department wants this. The Ukrainians and the State Department, the Blinkens and the Newlands and the Kagans and all those people, the Vindmans, they all want this. The British need this because they've guaranteed all this debt, and they've made guarantees to everybody about how they were going to carve up Ukraine after they destroyed Russia, and then force the Russians to pay reparations. And everybody, you know, attendant to that group that fomented all this, we're going to get paid. So that's the BlackRocks and everybody else. I mean, and by the way, JP Morgan is involved in that as well. And yet, to listen to Jamie Dimon speak is like, we need to let Trump come back to power, and the hell with Ukraine. So, like, you know, what's going on there, right?
Yeah, and hasn't there been posturing within the State Department and Blinken get put on the sidelines as well? I read that last week.
Yeah. Well, what happened, I think, was, yeah, there's a lot to unpack. I'll be honest with you, Marty, like, part of me is like, it's all going to be fake and gay until the election, so I'm just waiting for the election to be over and done with. But, you know, last week, the two things that happened, and when I get to that point sometimes, I realize that all I have to do is wait for the two really discordant pieces of information to happen, and then everything else doesn't matter. Everything else is kind of downstream of those two events. And the first event was when Lloyd Austin met with Zelensky in Mannheim in Germany and told him flat out, you're not getting any more missiles, and you're not getting our permission and our support, logistical support, to strike targets deep in Russia. We're not doing this. And then the next day, Blinken and David Lammy, the UK foreign secretary, are in Kiev telling Zelensky, oh no, you have our permission to do all these terrible things. And then right after that, they blow up a massive ammo dump in Russia. And the Brits then almost pretty much take credit for the whole thing. And like, there you go. Everything else is downstream of this. And in the context of the stuff that the content that I've put out with my friend Alex Craner, both in podcasts we've done together, and then he was on my podcast, and the stuff that he's put out on his Substack. And if anybody hasn't read that work or listened to those podcasts, I absolutely urge you to do so. Not for me, but for Alex, because Alex is fucking killing it. And he pretty much figured out that Ukraine is in default on the original tranches of debt that were issued through the IMF to them, which the British guaranteed. This is the TLDR, is that the British guaranteed a whole bunch of debt through the IMF, and now Ukraine is in default. And that they were given a two-year grace period, which ended on August 1st. And in the lead up to August 1st, Zelensky goes and addresses Parliament. He addresses the cabinet, the British cabinet, which a foreign leader hasn't addressed the British cabinet directly in like 60 years. So this is existential to the British at this point. So they need somebody to come in here and try and make this war happen. And it's analogous to what they did in World War One, in the lead up to World War One. Give me just 2 minutes to explain this, and then I think it'll all make kind of sense here. In World War One, the British borrowed a fucking ton of money from the Americans, right, in order to fight the Germans. The French did the same thing. So the reason why Woodrow Wilson, I got that right for the first time, I always get him and Hoover mixed up. But Woodrow Wilson was so gung-ho into getting us involved in World War One was because we had a whole lot of debt that would have gone bad, right, in the United States, in the American banking system, American investor classes, if Britain and France couldn't seal the deal. And so Versailles is as much a punishment system in order to ensure that the British paid the Americans back. And then there's some stuff about the Dawes bonds after the German hyperinflation and everything else. But everything that happened between World Wars One and Two, relative to currencies and debt and everything else, were all designed to get to extract the wealth out of Germany to pay reparations, particularly in perpetuity, to Britain and back to the United States. So the British put themselves in a vulnerable position. And Hoover, Wilson, I cannot get these two straight. I always do this. It's so funny, and because they're both terrible. Wilson goes. It needs to go into World War One, and aside from the fact that he was effectively a British agent anyway, he was elected. He was brought to power in order to, you know, repair in order to bind the United States and Britain together in an alliance, which had knew previously they were our greatest enemy, right, for 140 years. So this was the big twist. We get the Federal Reserve, we get direct election of senators, we get World War One. All that stuff happened during the 19-teens that fundamentally changed America completely. And one could argue that that would be the third American Revolution. The first one we won. The second one was the war between the states, and the third one was, you know, like December 1913 when we got the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, and the Federal Reserve Act. So you put all that together, and the same situation is playing itself out now. The Bank of England is in a serious threat of default, effectively bankruptcy. Because of Ukraine war debt and some other things, like, and then there's the gilt crisis of 2022 that Alex tied into all this, which is also fascinating, like brilliant work on his part. When you realize that they need this, they need the United States to come in and bail them out again, militarily, in order to bail them out monetarily. And so that's where this stands. And the difference now is that we have a Pentagon that is uninterested in doing this. And even this is even with guys like Austin, who are not what I would call the greatest of American patriots or anything. Like, I don't see Lloyd Austin as, you know, any great, you know, figure here. But, you know, when you look around, you see the shape the Navy's actually in, and not just the thing about the carrier group, you know, losing its refueling ship, then having to, like, you know, scramble to try and get everything refueled. That's just one part of it. Like, there's been a lot. This is a big subplot, which is that the Navy is unprepared to fight a real war. And so why are the British, our greatest allies, trying to get us involved in two major wars, one land war in Asia and the other one basically a naval support war in the Middle East, if we're not capable of fighting either of these things? It's got to be because they want to destroy us. This is the classic moment of, like, destroy yourselves in an orgy of violence, and whatever capital is in the United States, so, you know, they're ready to pull the plug on us, liquidate us, and move all the capital back to the insouciant wise and internal European Union, which is of course the point here, or back to the City of London. And then let them fight it out as to who's going to run the world later on. And I still believe that City of London is trying to fight Brussels on this. And Brussels, of course, is winning, by the way. So, you know, I don't know. That's what I see. It's a very and again, I could be wrong about all this, but I don't know. That the thing between Austin and Blinken the very next day, and then there was the I don't know if you saw Larry, this thing with the video with Larry Wilkerson and Judge Napolitano, and Wilkerson's not the only one who's put this story out there, which is that The Pentagon went to the White House and told Joe Biden there will not be a war for Israel in the Middle East. We will not fight this war. We're not going to fight in Ukraine. We're not doing any of this. And you're going to stand down. And that if you, there was the article, I think, on Zero Hedge, was there a coup in America? Was there a military coup in America?
Yeah.
And I know that it's true, but, you know, it's certainly something for us to consider.
And that's funny you mentioned. It's funny you mentioned that because right before you hopped on, I saw a tweet from an hour ago that the State Department announced that they're not going to be sending intel to Israel in Lebanon, which would be a de-escalating move. And then,
it's surprising, actually. And that would mean that maybe that Blinken has been properly reprimanded or brought to heel or whatever. I don't know. Because he's been literally running around running the country. Like, as far as I'm concerned, he's been like, you know, he's been running the show for a while now, since Biden was sidelined.
Well, it's funny you brought up the restructuring of Ukraine's sovereign debt, because we actually had a guy who runs a credit fund on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he brought that up when they were doing the restructuring towards the end of August, beginning of September. Said their yield was trading at like 18%. And I asked the question somewhat naively, like, wouldn't they want the war to stop if you're restructuring this debt and buying these bonds? Wouldn't you want the war to stop so you have like economic growth, you're building from zero, and you can actually build an economy that would pay that back?
Right. And the answer, his answer was?
He didn't have, I think, that would make sense, but like, who knows what's going to actually happen.
Right. It's what should happen is not what is happening. And what is happening is that the, it's not about Ukraine. Like, they know they need Russia's, there's a couple of things. They want Ukraine's physical assets. They want the oil and gas under the Sea of Azov and the Eastern Black Sea.
Trillions of dollars.
They want the coal, the lithium, all the rest of it, right? The steel, like, they want all of that stuff. $10 trillion, they say, they think of, you know, of assets in that area of Ukraine alone. And the EU wants that to happen as well, because the EU wants to bring Ukraine in, but they can't bring Ukraine in with just the farmland, because then the European farmers would be uncompetitive. You watch the prank phone call with Boven and Alexis and Radoslaw Sikorski, the former Polish foreign minister, who's, by the way, a complete and utter British asset, period. Like, period, paragraph, end of story. The guy was educated in the UK. He speaks with a freaking British. He's Polish, but he speaks with a British accent, for Christ's sake. Like, you listen to him, you're like, oh my God, you are such a British asset. He's the guy who tweeted, thank you, USA, for blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. So he got caught in one of these prank phone calls with Vovin and Alexis and gave the whole thing away. You know, said, look, you guys are not going to become part of the EU until we can figure out a way to bring you in such that, you know, the European farmers won't be pissed off with you, because you will outcompete all of our farmers. So by extension, if you can bring Ukraine in and, you know, create a European oil and gas sector, for example, and blah, 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 if you can move the money in there, then we can have we can balance this out, right? That was one. The other thing he said, which was very, very interesting, he said, you're not going to see Polish troops in Ukraine unless there's a ceasefire. And then we can be brought in, then they can be brought in as peacekeeping troops, which of course is, you know, that's the standard plan. Hey, let's call a truce. And then, you know, gear up for round two of the war. Putin, of course, understands this and is not going to give them anything. As a matter of fact, what he's doing now is he's now finally letting his military, like, really make some serious gains in the Donbass. Like, it's very clear now he's taking very specific, strategically important targets for the first time since Bakhmut. So there's no coincidence here that they're making serious moves on Chasiv Yar and Voldahar, I think is the way you pronounce that one city, and a couple others. And this is, you know, they're attacking the Donbass front from six different directions. while the Ukrainians have pushed all their best troops into the Kursk incursion. And these people still think that all we have to do is embarrass Putin enough and the hardliners will overthrow him. And now I'm not going to disagree with that at a fundamental level. There is a portion of that that's true. The question then you have to ask yourself is Putin that precariously placed at the top of the Kremlin today? I don't think so. So while I'm saying that knowing full well that the person who's been promulgating this idea is Martin Armstrong, who, you know, has serious, like, on the ground intelligence in that part of the world. So I can't discount that strategy completely, right? I can't discount it completely. So, but it just doesn't ring true to me that Putin would be that vulnerable to this kind of thing. But that's also why you've seen the escalations to the point of hitting Russian ammo dumps and really trying to embarrass Putin at the same time as we're about, I think that the Q4 is a very important moment. Like, I think the next week is going to be very important because it's the beginning of Q4 and it's where everybody's going to start reassessing their investment strategies going into the fall. You know, at the end of every quarter, there's never really much movement per se in the important markets because the 2 and 20 carried interest guys want to book their profits for the quarter, and the banks are dressing their balance sheets, and the central banks are doing their thing, and everybody's like trying to get through to the end of the quarter. And then once Q4 starts, then that's why the first Monday in October is always the potential blow up phase, because that's when everybody wakes up and goes, okay, now let's get real for 2025. What are we going to do? Right, we're getting set up because Q4 trades differently than Q3 does, which trades differently than Q2 and Q1. And you have to kind of assess markets in that way, and I think that's part of what's going on here. That, and of course, you know, American elections are in November of every other year, so there's the proximity to American, you know, political shakeup along with everything else and potential for policy changes and whatnot. So, yeah, like there's a lot going on here, and it's all kind of coming together around the same time period.
Yeah, no, we definitely, I mean, in the venture world, we definitely see that, particularly with the larger institutions, pensions, endowments. It's like, all right, Q4, we're going to figure out our 2025 allocation strategy and then come back to us right beginning of the year. This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price, below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com. No, it's like bringing this back to like the assassination attempts. And that's the right. Other weird thing, like pulling Iran into this, obviously in parallel, Israel, the pager bomb thing was insane precedent in my mind to do that right. Type of distributed remote attack.
Right.
Their video of the Ayatollah making like a mockery video of Palm Beach saying that we have you in our crosshairs. That's the thing. Like if that is like not only a diversion, but they're trying to blame it on Iran, but like Trump seems to be embracing it. Do you think Trump is aware of these plays and he's sort of playing along with it for gotcha, or do you think he's somewhat blissfully unaware of
No, I think he knows exactly what's going on. And I just don't think he cares at this point. He's like, well, if they're going to take a shot at me, they're going to, I mean, they already shot him once, right? So once you get, once you make your peace with, I would imagine, I mean, I've never been in a situation that's been that sincere. Like, I've never been shot, right? But, you know, once you've committed yourself to a particular course of action, right? You're pot committed in poker speak. And you go, yeah, all right, I've accepted the risk of this. And, you know, I can, the closest thing I can come to in my professional life is that moment when the FBI showed up at my door and wanted to ask me about my relationship with Strategic Culture. And I had to make a decision about what it is how I'm going to, you know, go forward here. Am I going to go forward with, going to confront evil and, you know, never give in to evil and go ever thou forth more boldly against it. And, you know, quoting Mises, or am I going to shrink and, you know, go do something else with my life? And I chose the former. And, you know, you get, once you hit that moment, like, you know, okay. Like, it was funny, this afternoon, Noor bin Laden was tweeting back to somebody. She either was on his show or something like that. And she's like, lovely to have talked with you. You're now part of my Gulag Club along with Richard Poe and myself and a couple other people. And I just responded to her. I was like, I'm holding out for Guantanamo, Noor. that's right. If they're going to take me, if they're going to send me somewhere, send me to Guantanamo. Like, that's, you know, I'm holding out for the best of the bunch. I'm not, you know, I'll accept no substitute.
Put me in the tropics if you're going to put me somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. You know, whatever. If you're in the, you know, if they're going to waterboard me, at least, you know, do it where, you know, just like do the thing. Like, you know, like don't be pussies about it. And I mean, so I don't know. I'm just kind of vamping here when I say something like that. I don't, you know, but it is something that you think about. And so I can see Trump just going, look, I'm pot committed to this. You know, I know what these people want to do, and I know what they're doing to me, and I don't care. And that's that. And I'm still going to be Donald Trump. And okay. I mean, what else has he got to do? I mean, he's 78 years old. This is now his legacy. Like, this is his legacy, not the buildings, not the business, he made the point of this. You know, he made a turn at some point in the past. Like Trump, don't like Trump. Think he's the right person. Don't think he's the right person. Over it. Don't want to see the second season of the Trump show. I don't care. Whatever. Certain point, you have to look. He made a decision on this, and this is his legacy. And the interesting part about it, on the other side of it, is his counterpart, Joe Biden, who everybody's now forgotten about.
Completely memory hold. Nobody.
Right. Right. But let's talk about the discordant moment when Joe Biden grabs a MAGA hat off of a kid and puts it on his head and then carries it on as he's going up the stairs to the plane. He didn't no one like came in and took that away from him and said, no, you can't have that, Joe. He's like, no, 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 this is mine. Like they took Joe Biden's $300 million war chest. Okay. They're fucking with the sentencing of Hunter Biden. And they're using it to keep Joe under control because he can't pardon Hunter until after Hunter's been sentenced. So they move the sentencing to after the election. They'll keep stringing him along. And Joe's like, you stole my money. And the Pentagon has now basically told him, look, we're done with Ukraine. I don't care. Like, you know, the British may want to get us involved in the war, but we're not fighting this war on their behalf. It's over, Joe. So if you believe, so with all of this and the coup story and the this, that, and everything else, if you string all those pieces together, did Joe Biden make a deal with Trump to stay out of jail, to this, that, and to get all this stuff done that the Democrats won't give him? Because they, at this point, I'm having a hard time even believing that anybody can even credibly put together a plan or a narrative that Kamala Harris is competitive in this election.
Well,
she's not.
No, well, that's what I wanted to get to. Part of the poll. But before we get to that,
okay, right.
Pulling on that thread that you're just pulling on and extending it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to go with that,
sure.
That theory, like Jill Biden sitting at the head of the table and running the first, whatever it was, committee meeting in over a year, I believe. It's just like an overt, like, we're going to make a mockery of this whole situation and make it obvious to the people.
Right.
Joe's incompetent.
Yeah, that's a good way to read that. That's a good, that Jill Biden is running a cabinet.
Did we lose him?
But I just, I was talking and then it said, thank you. I'm like, what? Like, but I didn't do anything. I'm sorry. Was I about to say something rude? Like, I don't know. I do say something rude. That's like my shtick. But no, the Jill Biden running the cabinet meeting was hilarious. I think the way you just described it was the right one, which is that the whole Biden crime family, think of the Bidens as one of the mafia crime families that run America. And Joe has his ego and he has his legacy that he wants and blah, 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 blah. And this is how he was going to get paid. And then they put him aside and stole his money. And now they're holding his quote unquote legacy over his head. And Ukraine was to be his legacy to continue into the future. I hope I'm not gone.
You're good.
That was supposed to be his legacy and for his family, and that they were going to be able to, you know, pull their vague off the world for the next two generations or whatever. That's the whole shtick of being in Congress was for 60 years was that. And this is, you know, this was the gold watch and the whole thing. And they took it all away from him. Now, a guy like Joe Biden, it's not like he's like, you know, we want to make fun of him now because he's been decompensating and he's sporifying as a mushroom in the White House and all this other stuff. But Joe Biden is a fucking prick, dude. He always has been. And, you know, he's a nasty piece of work and he's angry and he still has 3 or 4 hours worth of lucidity a day. And he knows exactly what's been done to him. So I have no problem believing that at that moment, you know, in this moment, if he's looking at the polling and they're like they're sitting around looking at it going, she doesn't have a hoot in hell of fucking winning. If I want to get out of this with anything intact, if I want to get out of this with my ass and my children's asses somewhat intact and get some of the money that was promised to me, I got to go to the other crime boss or the incoming crime boss, and that would be Donald Trump. And that makes sense to me. It seems far-fetched. It seems weird. I'm not saying it happened, but it makes sense. Hence the whole MAGA hat thing and, you know, and putting all that together. So, you know, go with it. I don't know.
Plausible. Well,
yeah, I think definitely, it's plausible.
Definitely it's plausible.
I think it's at least fun. We just talk about it. We don't always have to like be right about this shit, but we should be entertaining about it. Let's entertain that idea and then see if it comes true.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. And going to like Kamala, like that's another big question I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. Like the polls are, I mean, we knew they've been fake in the past, particularly in the 2016 election, the polls leading up to the election, and that result proved that the polling was way off. And this seems even more far, like in 2016, it wasn't even far-fetched. It was a bit surprising that Trump won because people were still riding Nate Silver and whatever the company he, I forget what it was, something 456
538.
Or whatever.
538.
And his polling was gospel, and Trump inevitably won, unless you were on 4chan. That was extremely surprising to you. And
wasn't surprising around, to though, me at all.
It doesn't seem like it seems completely off kilter, the polling.
Yeah.
And it is. You see Kamala going to campaign rallies and doing very few press conferences, but when she does, she inevitably winds up putting her foot in her mouth or sounding a complete idiot, the whole thing with Oprah and the celebrities. Mm-hmm. I think that came off completely disingenuous and terrible. The debate, even everybody was saying that she won the night of, but if you actually listened to it, didn't watch it, she didn't have any substance. She hasn't this whole time.
Right. And the polls moved against her. I watched a couple of good videos and watched it and some good, read a couple of good articles on the polling. That she's polling far behind in all the battleground states, where even Hillary was in 2016, or where Biden was in 2020. In every one of those, the battleground states, she's lost ground since the debate. Every one of them, like 4 points, 5 points. Like, I think Virginia's in play. I think that with some of the latest court rulings that will tighten up certain battleground states, I think, it's going to be harder for them to cheat. And then remember, in the national polling, she has to be 3 to 4 points ahead of Donald Trump in national polling in order to have a prayer of winning. Democrats need at least 3.5 to 4 points and the national average to win, to be winning, because they're behind in so many of the battleground states otherwise, because they have such a massive advantage in places like New York and California and others. And that's the that's the margin of cheating. And so, when I'm looking at the map at this point, I was doing a 270 to win the other day, or yesterday, I think I was doing one of those, filling it in. And I think Trump's going to take 2 of 3 in WMEPA, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. He could possibly take Virginia. And if he takes Virginia, forget it. If he takes Virginia, she doesn't have a path to victory. Just take everything else. She's not going to carry all those other battleground states. She's not going to carry Georgia. She's not going to carry Arizona. She's probably not going to carry Pennsylvania. She might, but they would have to do epic levels of cheating that will be easily uncovered this time. So what I would say is I think they're preparing. This is what I think is more sinister than that. I think they're preparing for Trump to win, but for them, they're going to try and queer the election results in certain states to decertify or and make sure that certain states can't be certified to ensure that those people can't go to the Electoral College. But that doesn't even make any sense, because then it goes to the House and Trump wins 38-12 because each state gets one vote. It's not a roll call vote in the House of Representatives. It's a state by state caucus vote. And in that thing, I think the Democrats only win 15 states maximum. He wins 35-15. There's mechanisms for this. So many people don't forget what the mechanisms actually are, what the law actually is. They're going to try and tell us what the law is. That's going to come from people not within the United States. It's going to come from the British and Davos and all the other people who are going to queer the friggin', they're going to push election mechanism nonsense at us to gaslight us about how, this is going to be Trump stealing the election. I'm like, no, that's not the way this works. We have mechanisms for this. It's in the Constitution. Read the fucking thing and get over yourself. Like, so that's what I think they're going to try and do. They're not going to accept the results of the election. They're going to try and decertify certain states, or, you know, or poison the election results to the point where we can't get a clear victory, and tie it up in the courts. And then, you know, and then I don't know what happens after that. Like we start a lot of nuclear weapons, and then we declare martial law, and we put the election on the back burner. Like, you don't think that's beyond these people? Like, no, are you kidding me?
I mean, it would be beautifully poetic if that's actually what happened, considering what happened in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I'm becoming more convinced. Like, how much of the calculus that the strategist on the Democratic side are running right now, like, she is so unlikable and so
mm-hmm.
it seems crazy to me that anybody can listen to what she says and think this is a viable candidate to be chairman in chief of the United States.
The United States, right? Exactly.
Yeah. It's
about this one, Mark?
Like, are they prepping to hand him a bag of shit from the financial economic side?
Oh, yeah, of course. What they're doing, that's part of what we're seeing right now with all these escalations. Yeah. They're trying to leave. Obama left him with a lot of poison pills in 2016, but they only had 2 months to prepare because they were expecting to win on election night. This time, I think once he survived Butler, Pennsylvania, now they're like, oh, we got 6 months. What are we going to do to destroy his presidency this time? Because now he's wise to our game about running roughshod around him in the administrative state. We've got Chevron has been destroyed. Jarkissi destroyed the Star Chamber courts of the alphabet agencies. Like, those two rulings alone put us in a completely different world legally, right? So they can't, you know, run the same game that they ran the last time, which is, you know, remember, it's the cabinet secretary that actually runs the United States. Executive orders are not orders. They are requests by the president to the cabinet secretary to implement these things. If the cabinet secretary doesn't want to implement those things, guess what? Doesn't get implemented. Now, the president can fire the cabinet secretary and put somebody else in place. And during Trump's presidency, first presidency, he was not in a position. I don't think he was in a position to really be able to do that. One, no one wanted to work for him because the whole thing was a shit show. If he comes in this time with a plan, with real people and a plan, a staffing plan that makes sense, and he's got people loyal to him, and he's got other people and powerful people is what I'm getting at, pulling in his direction. And this is where I would listen carefully to Jamie Dimon saying, you know, we should really listen to these MAGA people. They're not crazy. They should be respected. And all my really liberal friends in New York have got it all wrong. You just said this the other day. Like, the fucking Jamie Dimon. Like, this is important, folks. Like, this dude's not on board with another 4 years of fucking Obama. Okay? He's done. And I go back to Davos 2023 and Davos 2024 with a guy where he shows up two times in a row. He shows up with a bag of poo in his hand and like drops it on the, drops it in the middle of the room, lights it on fire, and then steps on it. Like, in Davos, told them all, hey, we're going to drill a lot more oil and expect 7% interest rates. Like, like, fuck your climate change. Like, are you kidding me? Like, This is the head of the most powerful bank in the frickin' world. And he's telling you he's not down with the Great Reset. Because what's the Great Reset? It's the Great Banking Reset. It's the Great Banking Reset where the central banks take over the world and cut the commercial banks out of everything. Right? And that ties into the stuff that you and I, that we were talking about right before we hit record. I was reading your article about Silicon Valley and Signature Bank and your discussion with Caitlin Long, which now that you've done that one, I need to sit down and I got to call Caitlin up and have her back on my podcast again so we can do this again. about, you know, how the banks were solvent, and yet Elizabeth Warren and company went after them because they are hostile to Bitcoin. They're hostile to, you know, digital assets that are not central bank digital currencies. There's a picture here. It's a very clear picture, and all you got to do is like embrace it and go, oh, that's what's happening. So yeah, no, it's a very interesting moment in time. Like this is a different world. And I think if Wall Street is on board with a second season of the Trump show, which I think they are, and I think Powell setting the table for Trump to come in, you know, in the best situation that he can under these circumstances, then, you know, we get past the turmoil of the election. And as long as we avoid, you know, antagonizing Putin and or Iran to the point where we have a massive shooting war that everybody has to respond to, then we could get out of this period in history with just a bunch of border skirmishes and some nasty financial warfare, which would be the best outcome for humanity. It's not a good outcome in the short term. A lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to lose their assets. It's going to be liquidations, and it's going to be terrible. It's going to be, but the alternative is the complete and utter burning down of the first world, and then the quote unquote build back better. Fuck you. You guys can't even run a conference well, and you think you're going to run the world? Like, fuck you. Like, it's just so comical, right?
You can feel the tide changing too. See, I'm sure you saw, but the optics of Tim Walz meeting with Alex Soros in a penthouse in New York, man of the people.
Yeah, man of the people.
Man of the people meeting, going to kiss the Soros ring in Central Park penthouse.
Did you see the video of him changing the air filter on his old pickup truck?
Oh my gosh.
Like, are you kidding?
He didn't even
change
it. He just took it out and put it back in.
I know. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, are you kidding me? I did that shit when I was 17 with my dad. No one changes their air filter. And by the way, and Tim Walz does not own a 1970s freaking Ford pickup truck. Like, no. And then, moreover, he's not, you know, turning a wrench on it and, you know, playing grease monkey either. Like, he's not doing that. Like, oh my God.
Well, they're completely out of touch when it comes to optics. So like, whether it's that, and then the momentum is shifting against them. Like, you have Javier Milei, Nayib Bukele going to the UN this week and just completely decimating like global socialism, globalist agenda.
Right. I'm still not sold on Milei. This whole him sending all of Argentina's gold back to the Bank of England. Not a good idea. Like, dude, that's not a good idea. And so I still have a soft spot for, and you probably follow him far closer than I do. But Milei just seems, again, another one of those straight out of central casting. He just seems too good to be true. And I just don't trust him as far as me. I don't trust him. And he's cartoonish. Like, dude, you don't have to be a cartoonish friggin' Austrian economist. Like, you just don't. Like, and so that to me screams like, you know, it's like he's as cartoonish as the freaking neo-Nazi guys that came out during like the Spencer, like the Richard Spencers
American
and those
front.
Guys. And and the TRS group from, you know, if you go back to 2016, the Mikey Nock and all those fucking guys, they were all fucking feds. Every goddamn one of them, you know, like, give me a break. I'm so over it. It's like, I'm done. Like, you know, and like you go watch the Patriot Front guys, and they're all feds wearing high end tights, wearing the same outfits with the same military watches, you know, and the walkie talkies that they can't even hide the walkie talkies. Like, dude, come on, we can see you, you know, like, oh my God.
It feels like they're losing. Again, they're losing on optics, and their message just isn't landing. Like, climate change, 15-minute cities, whatever it may be. Everybody's like, all right, I've had enough. We're not going this direction. But, like, bringing it back to the newsletter I wrote and the conversation I had with Caitlin, and Jamie Dimon's posturing. Like, I could see, like, if we have an inter-cabal squabble within the U.S. federal government regulatory agencies, mm-hmm. where you have Warren and crew really trying to push this Davos agenda, CBDCs, all of that. Like, this may be where they really dropped the ball and fucked up massively, is with what happened, what I wrote about, what Caitlin and I talked about, which is by targeting banks that were servicing Bitcoin companies, particularly Silvergate and Signature, mm-hmm. it essentially incited the bank runs that happened last year and created that banking crisis
right.
in March of last year. And mm-hmm. again, just pulling on the thread that you put out there and running with the idea that Jamie Dimon is sort of fading that part of the inter-cabal squabble. Like mm-hmm. he'd be like, you literally incited a banking crisis, even though he did benefit massively. JP Morgan absorbed one of the banks. Their market cap went up $15 billion. Mm-hmm. But maybe that was just like a positive externality of a crisis that he believed could have had severe negative externalities. Mm-hmm. It was all because they were targeting these banks, like we said, Silvergate. That's why I had Caitlin on, because Elaine Heatrick from Silvergate, the chief administrative officer, published an affidavit as part of their bankruptcy filings and proceedings. Basically said our hand was forced. We had the money to give back to our depositors. If anybody came to our window and said, hey, we need our dollars back, we had the dollars, we were giving them back. And essentially the Fed, whether it was Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve directly, or one of their Federal Reserve bank branches, said, hey, we're going to need you to reduce your exposure to Bitcoin and crypto related businesses to 15% of your book. And at mm-hmm. that point, 100% of their book was Bitcoin and crypto related right. businesses. And so right. they're like, nobody knows the exact timeline they gave them, but right. everybody's running with the assumption it was like, you got to do this in a month or two. And they're like, we can't right. do it. So we'll just give everybody their money back.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
A panic.
Right. Right. And that created the panic and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, and the history happens. Right. No. And I was just thinking about that. And I was thinking about the conversations that I've had with Caitlin, because we've been trying to square, you know, the arguments that I've been making about what the Fed is trying to do with what's happened to her with Custodia Bank. And it's been a real conundrum. And we've had multiple conversations on this, and I it's been hard for me to make heads or tails of it. What I can say is the following: no argument that the Fed is not. I think if the Fed is okay with Bitcoin having a certain role, it's not. It's in having it. They're okay with it having a certain role as long as they have, you know, it's ring fenced in a particular area of the market that serves their interests. Right. That I can see. Right. I can also see that there are plenty of big players on Wall Street that want in on the crypto banking game as well. And they want that business, and they don't want that business in upstart banks. They want it in banks. They want that business. So they would be happy to piggyback on Elizabeth Warren being, you know, doing her Davos thing and then them benefiting from it by absorbing the book of business, i.e. Silvergate Bank, and all the rest of it. And then if they have competing technologies to, you know, Tether or to some other stablecoin. And then there's the other side of it, which I still think my angle on it has a role to play as well, which is that don't just look at the fact that those banks were solvent. I think that's fine. I have no problem believing that Silvergate and Signature were on the up and up, but in that respect. But at the same time, we also know that FTX was a freaking money laundering scheme for evil Davos money to destroy our fucking political system. Like, this is it's that argument that I've been making for a long time, that the money goes out, gets levered up at 0% through the Eurodollar markets, and then comes right back into the United States to destroy us culturally and economically and legally and everything else with our money that they levered up. And then, you know, and then they create a bunch of Ponzi schemes to pay everybody to go run around in Black Bloc and burn down Minneapolis. Like, this is like, it's reality, folks. This is what they've been doing. And the fact that, and the timing on FTX's I still go back to the timing on them taking out FTX was on election night, 2022. Like literally the next morning. Oh, the red wave didn't happen. Yeah, and we executed this Democrat bank, this Democrat, you know, money laundering operation, crypto operation the next morning. As far as I'm concerned, like that had to be the Federal Reserve. Right. If you believe that, you know, and it still fits that like Powell and company and Wall Street are trying to they responding to the greater global macro picture that the world is moving back towards mercantilism. It's moving away from globalism to a regional currency block world. And when you have the world's reserve asset and trade settlement, dominant trade settlement currency and all of this, how are you going to do that and not cause massive dislocations? Well, you have to start the process of changing the flow of dollars around the world. The first thing you got to do is start draining the offshore dollar markets, which is what we've been doing for 3 years. At the same time, you have to then start cutting off all of these avenues of massive leverage within those systems. And so you go after the euro dollar markets, it's easy. You raise interest rates to 5%, and all of a sudden, you know, they can't infinitely rehypothecate dollars through the shadow banking system. But part of the shadow banking system was created, you know, part of the shadow banking system today involves crypto. So that has to be executed as well. Okay. It's not that crypto is a bad thing. It's that that version of crypto, that era of crypto, had to be destroyed if their goal is to get control of U.S. monetary policy and make it work for the United States as opposed to the world. And so it's just, in a sense, these banks kind of got caught in the crossfire or kind of caught in a drive-by shooting between, you know, bigger players. And that may be the way, you know, that's the way I read it. And then, and as I said to Caitlin, I'm like, you know, I'm hoping one day that you and the Fed can come to an arrangement when the time is when, from their perspective, it is going to happen for them, but it's going to happen when the time is right for everybody to allow that to happen. And that's the frustrating part for her. And that's just, I think that's just reality. She's trying to do it right, of course. And I applaud her effort. I want to see Caitlin succeed. I want to see Custodia Bank succeed. I want to see all these people like removed from power. But, you know, then there's reality, and reality is sometimes reality is a harsh mistress. So,
yeah, no, a couple of things here. It was interesting after that affidavit was published, I believe it was Thursday or Friday of last week, over the weekend, headlines started popping up like, oh, we're going to not have to force through the SAB 121 bill. And we're going to maybe test things out with BNY Mellon first. We'll let them custody Bitcoin, on behalf of their clients. And so it was like
BNY, it was a Bank of New York Mellon, huh? Oh, you mean Davos yeah. Bank?
Yeah.
Yeah. Davos Central on Wall Street. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
So that headline came out, and then you have what's going on this week. And that's like, you know, the other thing with Custodia, that's where I think the Fed could be messing up. Yeah. So Custodia trying to get their master account. They're corresponding with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City for some reason. Maybe it's the closest in proximity.
I think it
to
is.
To where they're domiciled in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And maybe what they have to do is interact with that bank. But
it is.
They wrote an amicus brief in July of this year. And this is where the Fed could really mess up, because the amicus brief was written by a really good constitutional lawyer. It basically highlights that the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City is extrajudicially undermining state law, and particularly the dual banking system, where you have state chartered banks and the Federal Reserve system. And constitutionally, you're supposed to have competition between those two. And if you're going to unilaterally deny a state chartered bank a master account, you have to have power from the executive branch. And since the Federal Reserve Bank branches, their boards and their presidents are appointed via the board, which is owned by the privately held commercial banks, like they may be breaking constitutional law because they don't have a mandate to actually unilaterally, arbitrarily decide that somebody, a state charter bank, can't get a master account. And so that, like, because that's what Austrians, Gold Bugs have been saying for years, is like, most people don't know the Federal Reserve is a private entity. And this attack on Custodia may be the lifting of the veil for the general public of their private entity.
You're right. And it's funny because Caitlin and I discussed the beginnings of that when it had that just come down. The last time she was on the podcast, she didn't have very much time to talk. So we only were able to talk for about half an hour because she had other things going on in her personal life and sad. And I have to get back to her and find out. We need to have part two of that conversation. But that's exactly the point she made when she was on, when she and I talked a couple months ago. Thank you for reminding me of that, because so much stuff goes through my head on a daily basis. I can never remember it all. But that is a very important point, and that may wind up being Custodia's like big contribution to the world. Yeah, they may never get their master account, but they may like finally put some controls on the Federal Reserve System, which would be phenomenal. And think, you know, then we talk about the article that Ellen Brown just put out about state banks coming back, and that the state of Florida is now considering creating a state bank in order to combat debanking of individuals and companies that run afoul of DEI and ESG. And again, this is why having a guy like Ron DeSantis as your governor, who's a former judge advocate general and, you know, an excellent lawyer, as your governor, is a good thing, right? Because Ron is very sharp. And so Ron knows exactly what he's doing. He's also a very sharp politician. So I give him, he's a terrible campaigner, but he's excellent in every other way. He's a tremendous, tremendous freaking administrator. He's done such good work for the state of Florida. It's not funny. So, you know, sorry, conservative treehouse crowd, free Republic crowd, but, you know, DeSantis is not a moron. Sorry. And by the way, he's on the Trump team. It's just, that's just the truth. So, you know, when you put it all together, like, that's a big deal. Like, if Florida goes through with a state bank, and there's like 17 other states that are doing this. We have this, the State Bank of North Dakota is very successful. So, you know, here we go. Let's get down to it. And now, you know, what's interesting about this, Marty, when I first, because this is now, it literally just pops into my head right now as we were talking about this, putting this all together. When I first theorized about what the potential for SOFR was, when I went back and thought about all this stuff back in 2021, and I was like having my great, you know, kind of Sherlock Holmes moment, and all that just, it was all just kind of happening and all just kind of like laid out in front of me. I'm like, ooh, that could be cool. One of the subplots, one of the things that popped into my head was that SOFR could catalyze going back to the original conception of what the Federal Reserve was supposed to be, which was a reserve bank in 12 reserve banks, regional banks, with regional interest rates and regional liquidity and blah, 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 to help keep the banking system, you know, in effect, liquid, but regional and competitive, so that the Kansas City Fed sets a different rate from the San Francisco Fed, from the New York Fed, and then wherever you have, you know, you have competition for capital based on regional interest rates. Well, I even asked Daniel DiMartino Boot this when I had her on the podcast. I said, could SOFR lead to the re-regionalization of the Fed funds rate? Meaning we just do away, it just replaces the Fed funds rate. And then everybody trades relative to a premium or discount to SOFR on a regional basis. And she's like, well, yeah, but they'll never give up that power. I'm like, well, obviously they're not going to give it up willingly. Yeah, duh. But she's like, but yeah, that's possible. Like, you know, so now start interfacing that with this move towards state banks, start thinking in terms of how the Fed might have fucked up badly in how they've handled Custodia, and the fact that that may be what Powell is actually trying to accomplish here, is Martin Armstrong has made the point many, many times. He's like, and I don't, as a doc, as an Austrian, as a free money guy, free and a free banking guy, I don't agree with this tag. Okay. But Martin has made the argument and that we can go back to the original conception of the Federal Reserve that will, and I will agree with him there, that that would be far preferable to what we have today, right? That a one size fits all interest rate for the country is dumb. It advantages certain geographic parts of the United States at the expense of others, right? So it's allowing, for example, there's high demand for capital and the capital in California, and you have a monolithic Fed funds rate. That means that relative to the demand for capital, businesses in California are getting it cheap, and Mississippi, for example, is getting stymied. Like Mississippi needs 3%, California needs 6%. We don't have that. We have 4.5%. And guess what? California is stimulated by 1.5%, and Mississippi is repressed by 1.5%. Well, it's no different than what's been going on in the European Union. Germany has, I thought about this, and Germany has used the ECB's target rate and the euro as a means by which to run an internal mercantilist campaign against its own member states. And this is how they've been draining capital towards in the European Union, how they've been draining capital towards the European Commission and towards Germany, and then reinforcing their power and destroying the peripheral states like Greece and Portugal and everybody else. And now they've turned their eye, of course, to Italy. Well, that's kind of what we're dealing with here with the Fed funds rate on the exact same thing. So getting back to a regional quote for interest rates in the United States would set the Fed back towards its original conception, which is better than the institution that we have today. It wouldn't be perfect, but never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Quote Murray Rothbard here. And like these things, and so I think all of these things are like, you know, kind of in play, right? And we're seeing the markets and then in the various states react to that. Now we're seeing, you know, market forces are having, you know, the states like want to start chartering their own banks. Yay! This is a good thing. This is a win, right? It's not perfect, but it's the right. It's a return to federalism, right? And it's a first step towards, you know, real decentralization. So you have that happening within the U.S. But what are you seeing from Davos and company? They want to take these national systems and make them global. We're going to have like one interest rate policy for the entire fucking world under the auspice of the IMF and or the BIS. And that's what they're going for. And that's what they're arguing for. And so those people are monstrous and they need to be stopped. And, you know, I firmly think that that's in accordance with the needs and the wants and desires of the people on Wall Street. At a certain point, the Fed's going to have to give up some power, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, and I've brought this up many times, like thinking of the path of least resistance. You give yourself up to that monster or concede that maybe you're over your skis in many different regards. And what is, like you said, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. What's better given the choices? Like, Americans have proven throughout a couple centuries, almost three centuries, that we're pretty willing and able to figure shit out on ourselves. Decentralization works. Federalism works. Mm-hmm. It got us to this mm-hmm. point, at least up to up into the early 1900s, and mm-hmm. it was pretty good right up until then.
Right.
This is a very optimistic, like, white pill, too. It's like maybe they're both systems, in some regards, one to a larger extent than the other, are collapsing in of themselves. And I guess that's the two different tactics that Davos versus the Western federalist system are taking. Davos mm-hmm. is going to double down on incompetency and trying to force everybody square peg into a round hole. And here it's like, all right, we ran this for long enough. Let's let the market figure it out.
Right. Well, and again, this is, again, where Bitcoin absolutely has a role play. And so does gold. And we may need both of them in different corners of the market to do what needs to be done. The BRICS are going to use gold. Okay. They're not going to use Bitcoin. They're going to use gold. And they understand gold. They're going to use gold. They're not, I don't think they're hostile to Bitcoin. But for right now, gold is going to be the gig. And for us, we have gold. We're going to wind up having to deploy our gold. I'm dead serious. Like, we're going to deploy our gold at some point. If we survive this. And if we don't, then the United States will break up. And Davos will win a round in that, you know, they'll target the breakup of the U.S. in such a way that the bond market, because that's always the target here. The U.S. bond market is the target, folks. It's like, let's not kid ourselves. You know, some of our capital and some of our ingenuity and, you know, our capital will escape their rule for now, but they'll think that, well, we're bigger now than we were before, so that we'll just squash those people later. And it's the way they think of Russia, it's the way they think of Iran, it's the way they think of China and all of this stuff. Well, the truth of the matter is that they're spending a lot of their seed corn right now just to maintain the position that they have. And they're very good at fronting inevitability and fronting that they're winning, because they know that if they show weakness at all, the whole thing collapses like a house of cards very quickly. Because, you know, that's just the nature of, because, I mean, eventually we'll have a bank run on Davos as confidence in its ability to project power collapses.
No, I think it's happening.
The year. Yeah, I know it's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you compound COVID, which many people thought was a speed run to try to force things and take the foot off the pedal for a bit. But now, like, the immigration crisis, particularly, it's like way, like, people, they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs, they're eating people's pets. Like,
the memes are great.
Many people want to believe that is fake news, but most competent Americans that don't lie to themselves and believe their lying eyes can see, like, no, this seems to be happening. You have, like, Pete Buttigieg coming out yesterday, crime rates are down. Everybody's like, that's bullshit. Like, every speed, like, they're accelerating at a pace that's very obvious. It's not like the frog boiling in water. It's like the water's already boiling and they're trying to throw us all in it at once.
Right.
Like, well, this is, you guys are speed running this, which signals that they're desperate and scared to an extent.
Oh, they're very scared. I haven't seen that, this level of scared for quite a long time, if ever in my life, actually. And that's not, you bring up Pete Buttigieg or my extra white likes to go butt giggler. I can't, like, that guy is just a butt giggler as far as I'm concerned now. And I love Dexter. He just makes me laugh, dude. And he came out and says, what a shock. We passed the Inflation Reduction Act and inflation was reduced. Like, oh, fuck off. Like, you know, like, he's getting ratioed, like, to hell and back again on that for that one. Like, oh, my God, you are so unbelievably unqualified for the job you currently hold. It's not even funny.
Yeah, they're not even good propagandists. Yeah.
No, it's really, they're really bad at it. Like, we're better propagandists for their stuff than they are. Like, we can write sarcastic memes about their shit that is better than the shit they put out. The shit they put out is just so friggin' bad, we just laugh at it. Like, it reminds me, like, it's funny. It reminds me of when I was a kid, we were being told about the Soviet Union, and I remember if we had a Russian foreign exchange student in my high school or not. It was something like this. But I remember hearing stories about this. Like, you know, at the end, you know, there's all these propaganda signs all over, you know, Moscow and St. Petersburg and whatnot about, you know, all this stuff. And we just looked up at the stuff and we just laughed. We didn't believe any of it. It was all nonsense. And it's that, you know, it's like they, you know, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. Like, you know, that's the way things are. And that's, I think we've reached that level of I don't know, crazy, to be honest with you. So, you know, I've said this before too. I just remind you, like, these are like the grandchildren of wealth, right? The grandfather makes the wealth. The son maintains the wealth, and the grandchild spends it all on hookers and blow. And that's the people who are running the show right now. And they're fronting because they've been taught how to present themselves in public as, you know, wise and insouciant and with it and above it all, but they're not. Did you see Christine Lagarde on The Daily Show, for fuck's sake?
I saw some tweets about it, but...
Well, aside from the fact that it was nauseating, I can only watch 5 minutes of it. It was clearly a moment of them, of that's panic. You put Christine Lagarde on The Daily Show with Mr. DNC mouthpiece himself, John fucking Stewart. That's them trying to sell her as a better, as a more personable, you know, oligarch than Jerome Powell.
Same week they did the same thing with Trudeau on Stephen Colbert, didn't they?
Right, they did, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing. So when you see, good point. So when you see a cluster of those things, that's them trying to sell the whole group. Trudeau's going to lose. Lagarde is going to be torn to pieces by the market and by the Federal Reserve. She's being torn apart by the market. Like, dude, they cut 50 basis points right on Wednesday, and we're still getting the bear steepener trade in the U.S. bond market. Okay? I was hoping they would only go 25 because I wanted to see this very trade happen, and I needed Powell. I thought we needed to have Powell disappoint the markets in order to get that. No. But he gave the market everything that they said they wanted, and it still is selling off. That's got Lagarde and Yellen. Well, let's just say, they don't know what to do. They don't have any other options at this point but to keep buying treasuries into a bear market, and they're going to get fucking crushed.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into this a little further, because you, I want to say you glossed over it earlier, but you mentioned it earlier, like Powell with the 50 bit rate cut setting Trump up for success if and when he gets elected. Because that, like, I don't know if you know, I was in New York last week when Trump made this pit stop at the dive bar in the West Village to buy some burgers and Diet Cokes with Bitcoin. And that was the first, it was Fed cut day. And that was the first question the press pin asked him. And his response was, one of two ways. Powell's either making a political move to help out the incumbent administration, or the economy is very bad.
Right. And I think it's the latter. And I'll be honest with you, I think Don's interpreting, I think that's the false dichotomy. Because cutting in September doesn't help the incumbent at all. If anything, history of the stock market, for example, tells you, and Daniel DiMartino Booth has been banging her shoe on the table like Khrushchev about this, that cutting rates is the signal that there's a top happening in equities, that equities roll over 6 to 8 weeks later when everybody realizes, no, the economy's shit, and, you know, and these valuations are insane. Now we have the competing problem of, well, what happens, what does that mean for the rest of the world? And what if we have a sovereign debt crisis unfold in Europe? Well, we're still going to get capital flowing into the United States. So we could have a very weird moment where the Dow goes up, continues to go up, grind higher. It just could be a flight to equities. Could just be going to being a flight to quality as we have an impending sovereign debt crisis in the short term. But I still think that it's setting up for, like, the possibility of, you know, a liquidity crisis somewhere within 6 to 8 weeks, which would be the election night. You know, those last couple of days before the election, where they, you know, all of a sudden, even the boomers, like, retirement funds, like, blow up. That's not going to be good for Kamala Harris. That's going to be for Trump. But it's also, the 50 basis point cut does help set up, you know, us coming out the other side of that liquidity crisis. If it's not centered in our markets, which I don't think it will be, I think it's going to be centered overseas. If I'm wrong about that, I'm wrong about that. But how I'm watching credit spreads and currency rates and whatnot, I was on with Tracy Shuchart and Lynn Alden this morning on a Twitter Spaces. I hadn't met either of them before, so it was great to finally get a chance to interact with both of them. We had a really good time, actually. And Lynn and I were coming to the same conclusions about the world from completely different perspectives. And I was trying to, you know, explain what I thought was happening and credit spreads, and like, no, there's something happening here. Like, the UK gilt market is in trouble. The Lagarde is sitting on the German 10-year in a way that is kind of scary. I've seen her intervene in a German 10-year before, but, you know, she's now sitting on it at 2.2% as opposed to 2.6%. Like, how did that change by 40 basis points? Was it because now the yen is 144 and not 162? I mean, what's going on here? Like, so Powell's cutting rates, and, you know, at some point, everybody's going to finally just wake up and go, like, dude, are you kidding me? Like, Volkswagen is going to cut 30,000 jobs in Germany. The biggest employer in Germany.
This is after BASF, like, already moved out.
Yeah. And, you know, and they're all going to move their plants to the United States unless you can get Kamala Harris to come in and destroy the quote unquote the tax haven statuses of the United States, which is what Davos has been trying to do through the Biden administration all for the last four fucking years. And and Obama before that and blah, 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 blah. Whereas Trump is like, oh, no, we're going to open this stuff up. We're going to bring the capital here. We're going to build stuff and we're going to have chips and it's going to be great. And he's not wrong. I know exactly what he's going to do. But what they have to do at the same time, and Powell's been very clear about this, and I think Powell's rebukes of the government, of the Biden administration, by a Fed chair coming out and saying, look, we can only do so much. The rest of it is now up the fiscal side of things. And if the, you know, the Congress has to get their fiscal house in order, we can only do so much over here. You can't ask us to do any more. That's not our job. So, like, that's unprecedented to have a Fed chairman say that. And then he didn't say it once. He said it like a dozen times. Like, every time he's asked about this stuff, and he gets, you know, some dumb, you know, 30-something from, you know, the New York Times asking him some idiotic question. He's like, you know, okay, that's not my, that I can't do anything about this. It's like, I can only do what I can do. It's still up to, it's up to Congress to deal with the servicing of the debt. And yeah. So, and if there's a weakness in a lot of commentary from very good people, people I respect tremendously, but their blind spot is this idea that because things have always been this way, they will always be that way in the future. That's a kind of Malthusian style argument, right? And they don't fully apply the law of diminishing marginal of the law of diminishing marginal utility, where at some point that's the return on that at that activity is no longer necessary, is no longer, you know, worth pursuing, right? It's the juice isn't worth the squeeze at that point. So we're going to, you know, take the capital and do something else with it. We're going to shelve that behavior and do something else. Well, in this case, it's going to be deficit spending. Like, at some point, you know, you've run out of balance sheet room. The Fed can't expand their balance sheet anymore, blah, 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 blah. Like, we can't do this. The debt GDP ratio is too much. The debt servicing costs are too high. What are we going to do about it? Well, how about we cut spending? Well, we can't do that. Well, yeah, you can. You got a trillion. Are you spending $1 trillion overseas every year? Are you? Hey, how about we get rid of that?
That you got Trump on the campaign trail saying we're gonna gut the Department of Education. We're gonna shut it down.
Sure. Like, I mean, what I'm saying, and the way I and what I'm actually arguing for how people should communicate this is to say, look. Yeah, that's great. I think the Department of Education is dumb. I think there's like a whole bunch of domestic spending that we do that's dumb and wasteful. But the counter argument to cutting spending is then GDP would contract and then unemployment will rise and then this and then this and then this and this. Fine. You're right. We won't cut that first. We're going to cut all the overseas spending. We're going to take away Samantha Power's budget over at USAID so that she can't foment color revolutions anymore. We're going to close some of the fucking bases overseas. We're going to bring that money home. We're not going to spend it out there. That's money we spend out there that has not a dime, that doesn't really flow through the American economy. So maybe 10% of it is, you know, the SG&A on that is 7%. So we cut a we spend $1 trillion overseas. We spend $70 billion in domestic spending to manage that $1 trillion worth of spending. SG&A costs is 7%. That seems decent. Okay. Well, how about we cut that out, and then we can deal with the $70 billion worth of SG&A spending in form of unemployment and retraining and everything else and finding these people jobs domestically. If we're not spending $1 trillion overseas, there's going to be $1 trillion worth of investment within the U.S. for them to, those people to go get repurposed and find jobs in the private sector in the real world. Like, this is, we don't even have to hurt domestic GDP. Gross GDP will drop, but domestic economic activity and real economic activity won't change at all. That's my argument. Like, if you, and I don't see how you can even argue with that point. Like, let's just start there.
You're coming off as a very strong America First guy right now. You got to be careful. Okay.
I'm sorry. I believe that the Constitution, as flawed as it is still the best foundational fucking document in the world. Oh, by the way. And I happen to think that we have the best freaking corporate law in the world. Oh, by the way. And the best legal system when it actually functions the way it's written. Oh, by the way. So fuck all these other people. Yeah. I want to see America go. I want to see that structure handed to the rest of the world like it was supposed to. And we didn't do that.
Yeah. No, and it's, I brought up, look, you can bring up the chart again, but it's funny, the connecting dots, like having this conversation with you 2 days after talking with Caitlin, connecting dots here, top left, executive branch, architects of Choke Point 2.0, Bharat, Ramamurthy, like he was one of the key figureheads that targeted the banks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now he's Kamala's lead economic advisor, is going on CNBC and pushing for unrealized gains taxes and that economic policy that would destroy the tax haven that you described a bit earlier.
It would destroy everything about capital handling within the United States. That chart is that slide is outstanding. Gensler is another one. Oh, I remember all the Bitcoiners, the bad Bitcoiners, frankly, saying, oh, Gary Gensler is going to be a chairman of the SEC. It's going to be great. He's a pro Bitcoin guy. He taught a Bitcoin class at MIT. Like, he hates Bitcoin. This guy exudes everything. I'm like, are you kidding me? He hates Bitcoin. It's going to be 4 years worth of him, sand in the gears, monkey wrenching, proper a crypto asset regulation. And he's finally getting excoriated for it on Capitol Hill. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Gary Gensler can go pound sand.
He can go pound a lot something other than sand, to be honest, as far as I'm concerned. But, it's starting to get late, Marty. I'm going to start getting really salty soon. So we may want to wrap this up so I don't say things that are really bad.
No, I don't mind really bad things, but I agree. I'm going to jump here soon too, but no, thank you for coming back on short notice because I wanted to follow up with the assassination attempts, but I think the economic stuff particularly is interesting heading into this, all the chess pieces being moved on the board. And yeah. I think it's another reason why I love the conversations with you, because it emboldens my confidence, because every once in a while when you're not having conversations like this and the news cycle hits you, you're like, maybe they are like making progress. And it's like, no, it's all projection. Like they're trying to project strength that has no foundation. And
they have a lot of power still, and they're going to use every ounce of it. And I hope that, this is a final point on the way out the door. Like, I hope that, I hope the hell I'm wrong that they're not blackmailing us with a nuclear war. Like, I'm dead serious. Like we could wake up tomorrow and be in a different world. Every day we all wake up thinking it's going to be, the way I ended this morning is that we just had an hour long discussion about one sigma events, like that things are going to move one standard deviation away from where they currently are. And, gradually this thing, stuff will move this way and that way. I'm like, let's hope we don't wake up in a 3 or 4 sigma world tomorrow, because that's a one sigma probability at this point. We have a one sigma probability of a 3 to 6 sigma catastrophic event, which throws all of this out the window. And, smoke them if you got them, folks. Like, I don't know what to tell you at this point. Like, I don't have enough sardines and freeze dried meat for that scenario.
Yeah, and as I said, we'll do our best many times throughout our many conversations. Like, that's why being able to do this is important. And I do think, compared to any other point in history, the means of communication that exists today is extremely powerful and being utilized pretty well by the people fighting a good fight on what I deem to be the right side of this battle that we have, the spiritual battle, if you will.
Yeah, it is a spiritual battle. It's an ideological one, and it's also a and then it becomes a pragmatic one very, very quickly. And that's the other thing we have to like remind ourselves of. And we have to keep that spiritual and ideological desire and our philosophical cores, you know, keep them, hold on to them, like cherish them. But realize that you also have to interact with a practical world where everybody has competing. There's so many competing incentives that you have to figure out ways of just be careful about. The way I'm going to put it is this. No one is any one thing at any one time, right? People in pivotal positions can be both, can be at simultaneously, or to quote Tom Stoppard, consecutively and concurrently, hero, victim, and villain, right? The three sides of all character. You know, and depending on how you view, how you look, when you look at a figure, for example, like Jerome Powell or Janet Yellen or whomever, you can see them, you have to see them from all sides. And I hate to even like do that for Janet Yellen because I think she's the villain. But, you know, look at a guy like Powell, who's a very pivotal figure, I think, in history. Look at a guy like Trump. Look at, you know, look at some of these people who are confounding in their, they're the fulcrum on which all of this will turn, and they're going to have competing roles that they're going to be want to be cast in, and we have to be willing to view them from different positions, from those three perspectives, even though we know in the like the grand scheme of things in our philosophical hearts they're one role, they're a villain or they're the hero or they're the victim. But a guy like Powell is all three all the time. You can't be Fed chair and not be all of those things. So that's the way I would, that's what I would argue, people for, to do a little bit more of. And if we do that, I think all of our commentary gets better. Yeah. It's what I try to do as best I can here and there. So, and I fail, you know, all the time, but I do my best to do that. And if I can do that, and it usually yields the best insights. It's like, well, let's just reframe that person and think of it from their perspective. Now what? Oh, that's interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think you do an incredible job of it, and it's certainly opened up my mind and changed my perspective on many things, and I appreciate these conversations more than you know, and I appreciate you doing this late on a Wednesday night. It was a fun one. I like the night riffs with you, Tom.
Cool. Well, maybe we'll do it. Maybe we'll just do it and do the evening thing again. That's fine with me. I'm okay with that. So I adore these too, Marty. I have a great time doing them, and it's always good to catch up. So let's do it again, you know, in 6-8 weeks, and we'll see where we are.
Yeah. Stay safe in the storm there.
I will.
And until next time, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Peace and love, freaks. Take care.